Erev Tov, good evening everyone. We're having our class on the Jewish home. It's a new semester, a new year. So we're going to begin from scratch. And so rule number one, our class is not about dating. Dating is before you get married. Dating, we have our dating series at the end of the year, as those who were here a month ago know. This class is about what happens from the chuppah onward, but not how do you get to the chuppah. This class is not about how do you find the right match, how do you choose the right girl, how do you develop a relationship with a girl when you're dating her. That's not what we're talking about. So don't confuse this class with that class. Our focus is how do you build a relationship? How do you build a connection with a woman? How do you develop trust and warmth and love? The most meaningful part of a person's life is hopefully the home they're building. That's what we're trying to build. And it would seem like it's something so easy, yet statistics show us that most of the world has a very hard time and fails miserably at the task of building a home. Now, I imagine for a minute that you're sitting on a plane, and after takeoff, the pilot goes, "I want you all to applaud. I did a great job on that takeoff." So you all applaud. And then the pilot says, "You don't get it. It's the first time I'm flying a plane." And you're all sitting there checking your seatbelts, right? And the pilot says, "But we're doing great. We're doing great. It's great, guys. I'm glad to have you aboard. I'll get back to you later." So you'd be panicking there. Like, what am I doing on this plane? And what's he doing driving the plane? And you hope it's a bad April Fool's joke. Yet, marriage is far more complex than driving a plane. And everyone, you know, you could learn how to drive a plane in a number of years. Learning how to make a marriage work takes many more years than driving a plane. And this is not my line. I don't remember who it was. I heard this line. I don't remember the name of the lecturer who said it. And he said he once said this line, and someone in the front row started laughing. So he asked the person, "Why are you laughing so hard?" And the guy said, "I'm a pilot. And let me tell you, flying a plane is nothing compared to making a marriage work. Nothing, you're 100% right." So, coming back to marriage, we walk into marriage and it's going to work, right? Because I'm a nice person and all my friends tell me I'm a nice guy and I'm easygoing and I'm friendly and I'm flexible and I'm understanding and I'm willing to accept that I'm wrong. And so there's no reason why marriage shouldn't work for me, right?
Saying that like he is, or he tells
it? No, sure I am. Every one of us knows we are. And we are. We are. We definitely are. In the world we live in that's pre-marriage, all of our friends would sign on the dotted line and say, "I'm a nice guy, I'm a friendly guy, I'm fun to be with, and I don't have issues. I don't have social issues. I'm a good guy. Yeah. So why shouldn't marriage work? All I have to do is find Mrs. Right. And when I find Mrs. Right, then it's going to work. And if it doesn't work, oh my gosh, all these people made stupid mistakes. But I'm going to get it right. And when you get it right, it just works." Wrong. There's no such thing as getting it right. So now it's going to work. That does not exist. When you get it right, that means you have someone with whom you will have to work very, very hard in order to make it work. Marriage is the most beautiful thing, the most beautiful thing, and it can only be beautiful if you're going to invest a lot of work. All those marriages that you look at and they seem great, that's because they're putting in a lot of work. If things go on autopilot, the marriage is a series of explosions. Marriage is miserable. I have what I need, she has what she needs, we don't talk the same language, I can't figure out what she wants from my life, she can't figure out what I want from her life. What a sense of humor God must have to make me marry a woman. It would be much easier if men could marry men. Then everything we said would work, right? All my friends like me, I'm a good guy, there's no reason it shouldn't work, right? But Hashem made it so that we evolve and we learn and we develop. And when we're open to it within marriage, so we learn from one another and we develop parts of our personality that we never even wanted to develop. We never even thought were lacking. And marriage helps us become whole. Chazal say, when a person's single, They're missing so many things, including themselves. Man in Torah is described as the union of a male and a female together. That's what forms Adam. When the Torah describes the creation of Adam, that great creature called Adam, Adam, the human being, is the fusion of man and woman. When the two can be at peace and build a home together, that's when you have the realization of that great potential called Adam. We would loosely translate it as Homo sapien or human, but that's not a real translation. The one who's supposed to be a reflection of God, who is Adam, the greatest creature God created on the planet, is man and woman together. So a person says, I'm willing to be flexible. All she has to do is be reasonable. I'm flexible. She just has to be reasonable. We will learn about how it just doesn't work that way. She is also willing to be flexible and reasonable. And somehow, we just don't talk the same language. So we're going to explore many, many different aspects of our relationship and how we can understand one another, how we can build. And the first thing we have to know is, if you're coming to this class, if you're going into marriage, then you have to be prepared to work. You have to be prepared to build. It's a process. It's a beautiful process, but it's a process. And it's hard. It is the most worthwhile thing you could do in your life. It is probably the hardest thing you will do in your life. Yes?
Did Adam get a name change when he stood up and spoke?
Thursday night. Back to marriage. Okay. So, next class, I'm going to give you each a piece of paper and ask you a simple question. Okay? Please define marriage to me. And then I'm going to ask you a second question. Please define love. And then I'm going to ask you a third and a fourth question. What can you expect from your wife? What can she expect from you? Four questions. Marriage, love, what do I expect from me? What can I expect from her? Okay? I'm telling you in advance. You can start thinking. Those are going to be our base questions. You don't have to hand in the paper. It's your paper. It's for you to think about. It's going to be our roadmap. You'll be able to compare notes in 6 months. What did you write today? And what will you write in 6 months? Let's begin. So you get married. What's the first challenge you're going to meet? I have news for you. The morning after you get engaged, you're going to ask yourself, did I make a mistake? That's the way it works. She will ask herself the same question. If you start comparing notes and tell her, you know, I'm having second thoughts, then in about 2 days, you could be at a point where the whole engagement is exploded. Right? One of the things that we need in a relationship is confidence. If I know you like me, then I like you. It's much easier for me to like you when I know you like me. But if I don't know if you like me, so then I don't know if I like you. It's hard. It seems weird, but that's what the pasuk says. Chamayim apanim lapanim, ken lev adam laadam. Just like you look into the water and you see your own reflection, well, that's the way it is between hearts as well. When you feel like someone likes you, so then it's easier to like them. But when you feel like someone does not like you, it's very hard to like them. So let's ask a question. Where does it start? You know, if she would only be warm to me, I'd be warm to her. But how could I be warm to her when she's cold to me? But then let's ask her, and she'll say the same thing. If he'd be kind to me, if he'd be warm to me, if he'd tell me he loved me, so then I could also be warm to him. Who's supposed to start? So what does the average guy say? Of course I'm going to start. I'm going to be nice, and I'm going to be kind, and I'm going to show my affection, I'm going to show my love. And what am I supposed to do if the fifth time I try doing that, she pours cold water in my face? And the sixth time, and the seventh time. So how many times am I supposed to do that? What's the first challenge in marriage? Did I make a mistake? Should I have married her? Should I have gotten engaged to her? This question is a recurring question that can plague a person his whole life. You'd think, you got engaged, it's over. Why do I have doubts? You'd think, you got married, it's over. Why do I have doubts? You think you're married 5 years. Why do I have doubts? 10 years, 15 years, 20 years, 25 years, 30 years, as far down the road as you can go, it is perfectly natural and normal to often ask yourself the question, did I make a mistake? Well, I have news for you. That question is probably the most destructive question a marriage can have. You know, you ever see people dive? So one of the rules they teach you when you go diving is either jump in or don't. But don't go running to the end of the diving board and start jumping and then start jumping off and say no and try to keep a leg on the board, because then you could kill yourself, right? You can jump in or you could stay on the board, but you can't try to jump and leave one leg on. That doesn't work, right? So the same is true with marriage. You can get married or you can not get married. But once you've decided we're getting engaged, we're getting married, you better go in head first. You put everything you got in it, because you have to believe this is going to work. You have to put everything you got in it. You have to give faith to the relationship. But then you get smacked in the face. Not literally. But suddenly you get a cold water in your face. Suddenly you get a cold shoulder. Suddenly you discover that your wife has tremendous weaknesses, such as she divulges all your secrets, such as she has this laugh that the whole shul hears. And it's not even a funny part of davening. Such as your spouse can't keep quiet for a minute. You're sitting and you're trying to concentrate, and you tell her, you know, I have to figure out the code to the ATM machine, because here in Israel, they swallow your card, and if you get it wrong 3 times, you just don't get it back. You have to go to the bank, and it's a whole spiel. And we're visiting here in Netanya. It's going to be, what am I going to do? Wait till tomorrow morning to get the bank card out? So give me a second, I'm trying to remember it. And she doesn't stop talking. And you're trying to think, what was that code? And she goes, but Chaim, I'm telling you, it was the most amazing dress in the store next door. You don't want to come see it? And you say, Sprinza, give me a minute. I'm just trying to remember the code. And she says, but Chaim, you don't understand. All the colors of the rainbow were in the flowers on the dress. Chaim, are you listening to me? Sprinza, give me a minute. But Chaim, I don't... And you ask yourself, Sprinza, how old are you? I tried explaining to you that I just need to concentrate to get the card out. And if not, one of us is going to have to schlep back up to Netanya tomorrow and kill a day or spend the night here. So how are you going to react when she does that to you? And you look at her and you wonder, didn't I ask you to give me a minute to think? Life in marriage involves frustration. Life in marriage involves not understanding. What's so hard to understand? I asked her for a minute to think. Why couldn't she give it to me? And you say, I got it. And then she starts talking to you as you punch in the code, and you did get it. But because she spoke to you, she distracted you. Or, as you're about to punch the code, she goes, Chaim, and she grabs your hand, and you hit the wrong number, and that's it. The card is swallowed up in the ATM machine. So you look at her. Now, what are you going to say? So what does she want you to say? I'm going to tell you a secret. This is a big secret, but you know what she wants you to say? I love you so much, this really doesn't matter compared to how much I love you. Oh, it sounds funny, right? It sounds like something only a woman would want. So let's just take the reverse scenario for a second, okay? Your wife got a company car, and you told her, you know, I'm not sure the accelerator is working right and you have cruise control, but it doesn't seem to release. Let me take it for a spin around the block. I'll see if I could figure it out. And you didn't figure it out. And the cruise control went zooming into a brick wall. And you walk out of that car and it's a wreck. And now she has to come back to her boss and explain that the cruise control wasn't working so well. And thank God you're alive, right? So you walk out of that car. And what do you want your wife to tell you? It sounded funny when it was her. But what do you want her to tell you when you walked out of the car you just crashed, and that's 80,000 shekel down the tubes and possibly her job? I love you so much. I'm so happy you're okay. That car really doesn't matter. Not compared to our relationship, but to the fact that thank God you're alive. Ah, suddenly it sounds different, right? That's okay. That's what we want to hear too. It's not just them. So there's a key component here. We enter marriage. Are we prepared to love the person where they are weak? Are we prepared to give them backing where they have faults? Are we prepared to overlook the things that are really annoying? I had a good friend who didn't shower often. It wasn't so bad. I mean, once every 2-3 months he would, but not so often. And when he got married, his wife said, he better shower every day. Okay. He came to me shocked. Came to me and he said, you know, she wants me to shower every day. I didn't say anything. I just smiled. I said, there are compromises in life. I didn't say anything. What struck me was they were divorced 3 months into the marriage. The marriage didn't last 3 months. And I don't know. I never discussed with him what happened there. I don't know. He didn't discuss it with me. I didn't discuss it with him. But let's say she would say, he's crazy. People see him down the street. They cross the sidewalk because they can't stand his smell. Is that a reason to get divorced?
Well, how do you want to quantify it? I'm not taking a side here. I'm just saying, like
I'm saying, we all have weaknesses, and our weaknesses are serious. We all have quirks, and we all are at peace with our weaknesses, so long as someone else doesn't point them out to us. And when we enter marriage, we want that other person to accept us and love us and be accepting of where we know we're not great.
So
to put it gently.
I'm saying there are two sides to this. Change or two...
It's irrelevant. I'm not talking about whether we should change. I'm talking about when you approach a relationship, you have to be prepared for two things. Number one, to be dedicated, to tell yourself, I'm not asking that question. The sooner a person decides, I'm in this and I'm going to make it work. It's not a question of will it work, it's a question of how will it work. Why is it that people ask, can I use birth control for the first year of marriage? You know, give me 2 years to make sure it works out right. Why? Why are people so intent on jumping off the diving board and leaving a foot on? How did people do it once upon a time that they got married and had kids and their marriages flourished, even though they were married to problematic people? Because at the end of the day, marriage is about making it work. And if I'm going into this, I'm going into it completely. I'm putting my faith in it. I'm putting everything I got into it. And if I'm going to try to do it any other way, it won't work. Because at the end of the day, it is human nature that we will question our decision. And we can question that decision our whole lives. You're going to wait till you're super confident that this marriage is working? I don't know if that ever happens.
No.
How many years were you married?
Almost 30 years.
Okay. Marriage, yeah, but we're going to discuss whether it's compromise or it's reality. We have to be prepared for the idea that we will be plagued with the question. We have to know that we, at some point, it can be after engagement, it could be the day of the wedding. But by the time you're going down to the chuppah, you have to decide, I will not ask myself that question. And when the question comes up, I'm going to tell myself, leave me alone. I made a decision. I'm going to make it work. And it's mind over matter. If you let things take their natural course, well, the natural course of events is that you will ask yourself that question. Now, for sure, you should never express it to her. That is the most destructive thing you could do in a marriage. One of the most destructive things you could do in a marriage. As bad as things are, you should never use the word divorce. You should never say, maybe it's over. Maybe we just can't make it work. Those are things that are never said, and that will be a class in its own right, to be discussed in as its own class. So our first challenge is mind over matter. Enemy number one of beginning marriages is that question, did I make a mistake? Now people like to cover it with religious aspects. I get this question often. Maybe in Shamayim, the spouse that was written for me is not the one I married. So now it's God's fault, right? Or somehow I missed. God had in mind I should marry the neighbor's wife, but I ended up marrying this wife. Oh boy. So you understand, a person can suddenly develop for themselves all kinds of fantasies. In psychology, they have a name for it, and in Judaism, we have a name for it. So in Judaism, the Torah says, Lo tachmod, don't desire. Your neighbor has his wife, and everyone else has their parsha, and you have your wife. And when a person gets married, they have to be focused on making it work with their spouse. When a person would get married in Israel, they used to ask him, Matzah or Motzeh? Have you found the joy of your life, or are you finding the woman to be more bitter than death? Right, two verses in Tanakh. One verse says, I find the woman to be, I have found the woman, I have found life. Matzah isha matzah tov. I found the woman, I found good. And the other verse says, Umotzeh ani mar mimavet. I find the woman to be more bitter than death. So the morning after the wedding, the guy shows up to Sheva Brachas and everyone's asking him, Matzah or Motzeh? Very nice. It's a scorecard. What rating do you give the new gal? Right? That's what's going on? No, that's not what's going on. They were asking him, what type of guy are you? Matzah, did you enter marriage and you say, I found it, great, I found my wife, then you will find life to be the sweetest thing in the world. If you are Motzeh, if you are constantly reevaluating, I find the woman to be, how do I find her to be today? What grade does she get today? What grade does she get tomorrow? If I am constantly reevaluating, then you'll find the woman to be more bitter than death. You have two choices in your approach to marriage. They weren't asking him about the girl. They were asking him about himself. What type of person are you?
Is that just an expression, more bitter than death? So Mara talks about what death could feel like, right? Like a hair out of milk, or trying to like fit a knot into a, you know.
Either way. We'll leave that for a Thursday night.
It's the joke about an older couple that she says, when I married you, I must be completely mad at those days. And he said, I would have known that. I really would have,
we touched on one more point, which is the point that marriage will always involve accepting challenges. Every one of us has weaknesses. I have to be prepared to accept someone who has their weaknesses, which I don't know in advance. As much as you date, you don't know. It's only when you enter marriage that you start discovering who you married. Yaakov Avinu gets into the chuppah. He's been dating her for 7 years, and it's only under the chuppah that he discovers it's Leah. The next morning, right? So we walk into a chuppah, and we think we're marrying someone. And the next morning, we start discovering who we really did marry. And again, the person has to decide mind over matter. I'm in this. It's not a question of will it work. It's a question of how do I make it work. And there's a world of a difference between the two. So that's the first step in making a marriage work. It's closing that question. I'm not asking will it work. I'm asking how am I making it work. So that's step one. I want us to revisit something which we did previous years. What we did was we took our class on the Jewish home and we would end it each time with a practical application. So now if I want to prepare for marriage, how do I apply this practically? How can I develop this tool? So I want to just suggest one tool that can be developed, and that is, it's called Ayin Tova, a good eye. We choose how we view other people. I once told the guys that we were having a new student come to class. Everyone should treat him nicely. He's one of the top people in Bill Gates, in Microsoft. He's a super genius and he's checking out the class. He's going to be here for at least one class, maybe for a day, maybe for a week. Try to be nice to him. He's considering what path he's going to take for life. So we're in the middle of class, and suddenly a guy walks in, and His hair is all over the place. It looks like he hasn't showered in weeks. And he's wearing torn jeans. And he's wearing sandals without socks. And you could see his nails are like this big. And the guy looks like a wreck. And you could hear the guys whispering, I guess he's too busy making billions to have time to take a haircut. And the other guy goes, that's just the smell of genius. And people are coming, they're sitting close to him and treating him very nicely because they heard that he's this person, right? And we're going on with class. And as we're in the middle of class, I had told the guys that the guy coming in would be from, Berkeley, California. We're in the middle of class, and 20 minutes after this fellow walked in, Rav Listman pops his head through the door and says, our friend from Berkeley, California is here. And a guy walks in with a three-piece suit, clean cut, clean shaven, looking the part everyone expected. And suddenly everyone looks at the first guy, and you see the chairs doing this, right? Everyone pulls away, like suddenly, oh, so he wasn't who we thought he was. Oh, no. What unsightly nails he has. And the guy just, wait a second, what happened? When you thought he was a super genius multi-billionaire, then it was worth sitting next to him, right? Then it was interesting. Then it was, his comments had a lot of value. Now suddenly you realize he's not the guy you thought he was, it's someone else, and leave me alone. Yes, well, we're all that way. We're all that way. It's a choice we make, how we view other people. So one of the traits we could work on is called an ayin tova, to look at other people positively. Can I look at other people positively? Can I see the good in other people? I'll give you a small example that happened this past Shabbos. My son was at the Shabbos table and he told me that he wants a bike like his big brother. So I said, when you get to your brother's age, then you could have a bike like your brother. And he said, I want one now. I said, then earn it. So he said, how can I earn it? So I said, what'd you learn this year? He said, I learned this in Chumash and this in Mishnayos. So I said, okay, every time you review the tractate you learned in Mishnayos, I'll pay you 7 shekel. And that way you could earn the money. Eventually you'll earn a bike. So we come to shul. And when it comes time for reading the Torah, instead of looking in the Chumash, I see him with the Mishnayos on his table, and he's plowing through the Mishnayos. He's going to make the money, he's going to earn his bike. And I'm asking myself, how do I put it gently to him that during Torah reading is not the time to learn Mishnayos? And I'm asking myself, like, as the laning is going on, how do I say it to him? And thank God I said nothing, because as I'm pondering this question, I had deja vu, I had a flashback to 20 years ago. Now, this past Shabbos, 20 years ago, I had went to a certain yeshiva, and I had gone there with all the intensity that I wanted to learn and become a Talmud Chacham, but I knew very little Torah at the time. And I came to the yeshiva, and I ran straight up, and I got a front row seat next to all the Rashi yeshiva. And there was someone there who was not one of the Rashi Yeshiva, but he was aspiring to be. He was a man in his 50s, 60s who had decided that he wants to be part of the educational staff, even though he wasn't. And he bought himself a big black hat, and he bought himself a long black coat, and he sat in the front row dais, and I had no idea who was Rashi Yeshiva, and who wasn't, right? He dressed like everyone else, so I knew nothing. And I'm standing up there because I want to get the most I can out of these great rabbis. And for what all I know, everyone that has a beard and a hat and a jacket, okay, I don't know any better. And I wanted to get the most out of everything. So I didn't realize that it wasn't so smart not to get enough sleep. So I'd go to sleep when I had no more strength to learn. And I'd be back in the base medrash at 4:30, 5 o'clock in the morning again learning because I wanted to get out of every minute. Not such a smart move. I don't recommend you do it. You need good sleep in order to succeed. But comes Kriya Satora. Everyone's listening to the Torah reading, but I want to make the most of every second. So I have a different sefer open in front of me, the sefer I was in the middle of learning. I wasn't listening to the Torah reading, I wanted to accomplish more. And as I'm learning, this gentleman, who I didn't know at the time, this gentleman walks over to me and puts his head in between me and the sefer and looks up at me like this. And the whole base medrash is silent and I could feel all eyes on me. Like, right, base medrash of 100 and something people. And when davening ends, we leave the Beis Medrash, and this man, who I didn't know who he was, walks over to me, and there are a lot of people around. And he says to me, I've seen a lot of students come to this place. I've seen students come, I've seen students go. And you are not going to succeed. You are not going to grow in Torah. Boom. Okay, so I get the smack in the face in front of everyone. And the next morning, I walked into the Rosh Yeshiva's office, and I said, I'm leaving yeshiva. And the Rosh Yeshiva said to me, you're leaving? Why are you leaving? You're learning. What are you leaving for? So I said, someone on your own staff told me I'm not going to succeed here, so I'm going to go to a different yeshiva. I'm not staying here. And he said to me, the person who said that to you, and he said in Yiddish, is a Rasha Merusha, is a tremendously wicked person. Don't listen to him. Stay and learn by us. And I said, no. And I packed my bags, and it was a flight back to my parents' house, and I went to a different yeshiva. But the Rosh Yeshiva had cursed that person. He said, that's a person who will not bother you. Stick around the yeshiva. 2 days later, the man had a massive stroke, and he was out of commission. Now, why was I reminded this story? Because some of you will remember, a month ago, I visited my parents. And when I visited my parents, I went to an old age home to visit my grandparents. And sitting next to my grandparents is that same Jew from 20 years ago. He's still with his unfortunate stroke. And I looked at him, I treated him nicely. Like I went over, I gave him some attention. And I'm sitting there looking at my son, and I was about to tell him something. What was the kid trying to do? Accomplish more learning, right? And what am I about to do? What someone did to me 20 years ago. Okay, so I'm not going to embarrass him in front of everyone. I'm not going to do it in a hurtful way. I just bit my tongue and said nothing, right? But suddenly I looked at him differently. Suddenly I looked at him and I said, he's trying to do something good. He's not trying to do something bad. He was given a challenge. He wants to learn more Mishnayos. We have a choice how we view people. Before I had that deja vu, before I had that flashback to where I was 20 years ago, literally this past job is 20 years ago, I looked at him and I said, so he has a challenge. He wants to accomplish earning money. That's more important to him than hearing the Torah reading. I should say something. I'm his father. And then when I thought back, I said, no, sometimes you want to learn something and you don't even realize the importance of Torah reading and you don't realize it's not what you should be doing at that time. And there's nothing wrong with it. So suddenly I could look at him in a better eye, right? My own son. Ayin Tova. Being able to look at someone else and see positively. It's a trait we have to work on our whole life. But it's a trait that comes forward in its great force in marriage itself. So challenge for this week. Let's try to take people who we're not so fond of. We all have our friends. And then the people, can we see what's good in them? Can we see the positive in them? Ayin Tova.